Welcome to the Barnes Review History Hour. This is your host, John Friend. Today is Friday, April 21st, 2023. The Barnes Review History Hour is a program where I will be interviewing contributors to the Barnes Review History Magazine, a bi-monthly print and digital publication dedicated to bringing history into accord with the facts, as well as other special guests. Please do consider subscribing to the magazine if you are not already. Check out barnesreview.org for all the details. And today I'm joined by Mike Maines, an independent author and researcher and a new contributor to the Barnes Review. All right, Mike Maines, welcome to the program, sir. How are you today?
I'm doing great. Thanks a lot.
Yeah, no, thanks for taking the time to speak with me. It is quite an honor. You are an independent author and a researcher, and you are also a fairly regular new contributor to the Barnes Review History Magazine, which I'm thrilled about. I love your articles and I love your take on things. You got a really unique perspective and outlook on history, and I know you have a lot of just interesting avenues of history that you're interested in exploring, which you can talk about here in just a moment. I do want to just mention, though, that the Barnes Review is a bi-monthly revisionist history magazine dedicated to bringing history into accord with the facts. In the tradition of Dr. Harry Elmer Barnes, the magazine's namesake. Our website is barnesreview.org, and it features a massive book collection, including some of the most important revisionist works out there. And you can also find subscription details to the print publication. And of course, I highly encourage all listeners to subscribe to the print magazine if they are not already. It is certainly not easy publishing a print magazine these days, let alone one publishing controversial, revisionist, you know, historical material addressing some of the most taboo topics in society. So please do support our efforts. Pick up a subscription today and check out all the great books that we have for sale on the website, and pick up a book or two or three. Usually when I go to the website, I find like 10 books that I want to buy. So sometimes you kind of have to limit yourself there if you're interested in this sort of, you know, these sorts of topics. But anyways, do check out the website and definitely subscribe if you're not already. I myself have been a subscriber since I think it was 2012 when I first discovered the magazine by listening to the late Michael Collins Piper. He had a weekly program on RBN, and he used to talk about the Barnes Review all the time. He was a major contributor to both the Barnes Review and American Free Press, and helped edit and kind of put together the Barnes Review for years. And so he was a huge influence on my thinking and kind of introduced me to the magazine. So I've been a subscriber for over 10 years now, and it is a really great publication. So I just wanted to mention that, Mike, and with that promotional bit out of the way, why don't you go ahead and introduce yourself to our audience? Tell us a bit about yourself, your background, anything you really feel, you know, comfortable talking about. And also, please let us know how you got interested in revisionist history. And maybe like what topics you focus on in your research and writing.
Well, I love to read. And like you, I'll go on to a website, you know, like they have, you know, for the Barnes Review. And there'll be like 10 or 20 books I want to get. But I'm a cheapskate. I'm a tightwad. I don't always like spending money. So sometimes I put off buying books, you know, and some, I don't like paying a lot of money for books because there's so many I want to read. So I've got a huge list of books that I've been wanting to read for a long time, but just haven't got around to it. Right now I'm reading Noah's Ark books, which are totally fascinating. The Freeman book, which I reviewed, was one that I've been wanting to read for at least 5 or 6 years. I don't even know how I first came across it. It's somewhere on some website. It might've been, oh, I don't know what website it was, but it, I've been wanting to get this book for a long time. So I happened to be on Amazon and I saw it, and it was reasonably priced. It was, I think, $11 or $12. So I went ahead and bought it, and it was a fascinating book. I just bought Red Symphony, which is another book I'm sure you're familiar with. That one was like $7 or $8. That was a great book too. I love history. I love learning the truth about history. The more I read, the more I realize that what I was told about history in school and growing up is just not true. None of it's true. And so I like to get the truth on any subject, whatever it is, math, science, history, you name it. I want to know the truth. So that's how I got interested in these topics.
That's interesting, and it, sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt you or interject or anything. I just wanted to mention, you're so right about, like, growing up and what we're taught in, not only in school but also even in university. I mean, I took a number of courses dealing with history when I was in college, and we're not really so much taught facts or genuine history. It's more narratives, right? They're politically motivated, politically beneficial narratives to certain groups of people who are dictating our historical record. And that's something that I've really come to realize, over the course of the past 10 years or more, since I've really been kind of thinking for myself and trying to get to the bottom of things and entertaining all aspects, all perspectives of various historical events. Because really, I mean, there's the old cliche that the victors write the history. And growing up in school, you're really only given one side of the story. You're not given the other side, or maybe there's three or four or five or six different sides to the story. So I think really that's what genuine historiography is all about, is looking at all sides of an issue and drawing your own conclusions. And certainly getting, doing that, you'll certainly get a much better, much more thorough and accurate understanding of the dynamics involved in various historical events.
Well said, and it kind of connects with something you said before we started the interview about the erasure of history. In order to control the present and in order to control the future, it helps to control the past. So if you can erase a culture's past or a country's past and replace it with things that just aren't true, that has a definite effect on the present and in the future.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, absolutely. Well, I mean, that goes back to that's like directly out of 1984, right? He who controls the past controls the future. He who controls the present controls the past, right? And I think it's pretty clear who controls the present and therefore controls the past at this point. And they're a very subversive force that is not at all interested in the well-being of traditional, white America or Western civilization in general. In fact, I think you can make a very strong case that they're at war with traditional Western civilization, and they have done a very, very good job of confusing us and deceiving us and misleading us and poisoning our minds with totally weaponized, politically motivated, historical and contemporary narratives about all sorts of issues, not just history, but race and gender now. I mean, my goodness, can you imagine even 10 years ago, the whole looking into the future and seeing like trainees everywhere and trainees being promoted as like corporate brands. And I mean, it's just really out of control at this point. But
I
yeah,
think
no,
if
you're
you
right.
brought that up, yeah, if you brought that up 10 years ago, people wouldn't have believed you, I don't think.
I don't think so. I think you're right. I think it would have been something people would just laugh at or be like, no, there's no way. You can't be serious. But sure enough, here we are. And it's only increasing. It's spiraling out of control with each and every day. And it's up to good people to stand up and say no and think for themselves. And that's exactly what we try to do at the Barnes Review, certainly when it comes to history.
Hollywood pushes this stuff a lot too. I mean, it's not just branding the beers, and it's you mentioned the Cleopatra movie. I worked in movies for a bit, and up until recently, when you made an historical movie or a movie based on a real person, you tried to find an actor that kind of looked like the real person. Like when they made the Buddy Holly story, they got Gary Busey, who happens to look a lot like Buddy Holly, and then when they made La Bamba, they happened to find a guy that looked a lot like Richie Valens. When they made that Doors movie, they found who was that guy from Top Gun? I can't think of his name right now.
Val Kilmer.
Yeah, but
Val Kilmer, yeah.
he looks a lot like Jim Morrison. And then they get the voice down, and as an audience member, you buy it because this is traditionally the way it was done. Now they're finding actors that look nothing at all like the historical person, and you think, well, why are they doing that? The only purpose it comes to mind is they must be doing it intentionally to whitewash history, to change so that people watching these movies in now and in the future that don't know any better are going to think, oh, well, that's the way it is. That's who Cleopatra was.
Oh, absolutely. And I mean, we see this, and I do want to talk about that in more detail later on in this podcast, but no, you're spot on. I completely agree with you. And I think that's a big reason why we see the systematic erasure of, for example, Confederate monuments all throughout the South, all throughout the country, really. I mean, they're changing the names of roads, they're changing the names of schools, they're outright tearing down, and if they're not already vandalized and, you know, destroyed, they're outright tearing down Confederate memorials. It's just an outrage. It is literally a, like, Stalinist purge taking place in modern America, and, you know, it's something that is never really expressed that way to, you know, certainly not in mainstream political discourse, but that's exactly what it is. It is an outright assault on our historical record, on the history of our country, and it's outrageous and it's unacceptable. But yeah, that's where we find ourselves. So getting back to the Barnes Review, I know you've actually written for the magazine previously. And we're going to be talking about an article that was published in the March-April issue, the current issue of the magazine, the March-April 2023 issue, which was an excellent, I think it turned out great. I don't know if you, have you got a chance, you do subscribe to the magazine as well. So I think you probably already have your physical copy. I have a physical copy of it as well right here. But you've, I know, if I'm not mistaken, I know you've written at least one other article that was published, and that was dealing with the infiltration and subversion of the Catholic Church, which mm-hmm. is a very interesting topic, in my opinion. That was the first article, right, that you had published?
I think, yeah, that was the first one. I don't remember. I've done two or three. I should know that which it is. I don't either two or three.
I think that was the first one, and I think this one that was published in the recent issue, the March-April issue, which is basically a review of Benjamin Friedman's book Facts or Facts, which you mentioned, you know, previously. But yeah, no, I think that was the second one, and I know we have a third one that's sort of in the works as we speak. But anyways, you are, you know, and can we actually maybe start there, like, to tell just our listeners briefly, like, what sort of aspects of history that you find the most interesting, like what you focus much of your writing on?
Well, it's hard, you know, I mix. I never really thought about that. But now that you ask the question, you know, I'm a Catholic and a traditional Catholic. And so I found it's kind of just came to my mind that I like history, but I also like the way it ties into religion. You know, I mentioned Noah's Ark and this book, Facts or Facts. I mean, you know, Freeman was a Jew who converted to Catholicism. So I like the mix of religion plus history. There seems to be an ongoing centuries-long battle between good and evil that's played out, not just in the religious spectrum, but historically. And it's been continuing for centuries. It's going on right now. Everything we've talked about up to this point, you know, the whole trannyism bit and everything else, it's basically good versus evil. And there's no middle ground.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I think that is basically a good, concise way of looking at it. It is good versus evil. There's no doubt about that at this point. And that is becoming, I think, increasingly more and more clear to more and more people. I don't know, maybe because it's so obvious and in your face at this point. Also, I think the alternative independent media has gained a lot of traction, certainly since I started, you know, blogging online, you know, over 10 years ago. I mean, we've made a lot of progress, and there's a lot of good work being done. There's still much more that needs to be done. But yeah, we've definitely made some progress, and I think the battle lines are being drawn, and it's pretty clear which side, you know, we should be on at this point. Do you stand with free speech and, you know, openly discussing all aspects of history and entertaining all ideas, or do you stand with groups like the ADL who want to literally dictate what can and can't be said, you know, with political discourse, with our historical discourse, and certainly what can be, you know, presented on the internet? You know, it's pretty clear which you know, the battle lines have been drawn, I guess, is what I'm getting at.
Yeah, there certainly are. I don't have a lot of faith and hope that the mass of humanity presently and in the future is going to, you know, wake up, quote unquote. I just think most people are sleeping and they don't want to wake up, and they're so immersed in sin. You know, habitual sin dulls the mind. And I think that's what's going on. People right. are just, they're so mixed up in drugs, alcohol, pornography, sex, anything to take their mind off reality. I don't think they're coming back to reality anytime soon.
Yeah, I tend to think so. I mean, at least the vast majority of people, and that doesn't mean we should, you know, simply give up or something, or all is lost or it's hopeless. But yeah, you're right. We do have a big problem. And I think that's really what drives me, is like, I do not want to be on that side of complacency and of sin. I want to know exactly what's going on, or at least to the best of my ability. And I want to live my life and fight on the side of truth and goodness and, you know, ultimately on the side of God. That's really sort of the way I look at it these days.
I agree totally.
Well, okay, I'll tell you what. Let's jump into this issue of the Barnes Review. I think I know I interviewed Carl Hamers when this issue first came out, so it would have been back in like early March. And we talked all about the lead article that he wrote actually for this issue. It was an article dealing with National Socialist movements in America before World War II broke out, a very interesting topic. And he's actually writing like a series of articles on the history of National Socialism and National Socialist affiliated movements in America. And this was just part one. There's going to be another one in the upcoming issue. So that was really like the main lead story in this issue. And the front cover is reflected in that. It's National Socialism in the U.S. before World War II. And there's a great photo of the German-American Bund and some of its top leaders with an American flag in the background. A very, very interesting topic, one that really doesn't get a lot of traction in mainstream historical circles, but one that is absolutely essential for understanding America and understanding the dynamics leading up to World War II. There was also an article published by Remy Tremblay, who is he's from Quebec. He's like a French-Canadian journalist and an author and a historian. He wrote a very interesting piece about the opponents of General Leon de Grelle in Belgium. So it was like Belgian political opposition to Leon de Grelle. Very, very interesting topic. The Barnes Review sells a number of Leon de Grelle's books, and he was a very, very interesting figure. I don't know if you know much about Leon de Grelle, but he was a leader in the Waffen-SS, a Belgian nationalist, basically very sympathetic to National Socialism, had a very, very interesting career in the military and fighting in World War II. And then ultimately after the war went on to publish a number of books, very, very interesting books dealing with World War II from kind of a, you know, basically more or less like revisionist angle, a pro-German National Socialist angle. So that was an article published by written by Remy Tremblay. We also had a piece by historian John Weir, who is he pretty much has an article published in the Barnes Review every issue, it seems like. And his article dealt with William Joyce, Britain's top World War II dissident, who was actually arrested and hung by British authorities for treason, for basically trying to expose the British public to what was really going on with World War II and the forces leading them to war, and was really sort of trying to present National Socialist Germany in a more positive light, a more truthful, accurate light. And then, of course, we have Your Story, Facts or Facts, which is a book review of Benjamin Friedman's book, which we'll talk about in more detail. Then we had an article by David Doddridge, who wrote about a major debate during the Civil War in the South over arming and training black troops and sort of incorporating them into the Confederate Army. That was a very, very interesting article on a very, very interesting topic that, again, doesn't get a lot of coverage in mainstream historical circles. I wrote it was more or less like a promotional type article for Monica Schaefer's book that she released earlier this year. Sorry, Mom, I Was Wrong About the Holocaust. That's the title of the book, and that was also the title of the video that she made years ago that ultimately got her in quite a bit of trouble over in Germany. And that book is excellent. It is available from the Barnes Review, and I highly encourage people to go out and check that out and pick up a copy if you haven't already. And then we had an article by Antonius Patrick, who's also a regular contributor to the magazine. He wrote part one of an ongoing series titled The Vatican and the Rothschilds, A Paradox. That's right up your alley there, Mike. The history of the Vatican and their dealings with the Rothschilds and other international, you know, banking organizations. So that was a very interesting story. And then the very last one was a story by Frank Joseph, and he wrote about a possible sort of a speculative article about a possible discovery of the lost city of Atlantis in the eastern Atlantic by the Russians back in, I think it would have been like the 1960s or 1970s. Very interesting story. So you can see we have just a wide variety of stories dealing with all sorts of topics. I mean, you know, if you look up the Barnes Review on like the ADL's website, you'd think that we strictly deal with quote unquote Holocaust denial or you know, World War II revisionism. But the Barnes Review regularly publishes articles from a wide variety of historical perspectives and on various historical topics. And I think that's reflected just in the table of contents I read there. So anyways, Mike, I wanted to ask you actually, and you sort of already addressed it, how the heck did you come across the work of Benjamin Friedman? Because I remember very, very vividly actually first encountering his speech at the Willard Hotel in 1961, which actually is a section in the book, Facts Are Facts, right?
Yeah, that's the speech. First part of the book.
Yeah, I was going to say, I know that was incorporated in the book. And I remember coming across that after visiting IamTheWitness.com. I don't know if you remember that website. It was maintained by Daryl Bradford Smith.
Not familiar with it.
It was probably one of the best websites I've ever come across, certainly back then, 2009, 2010. He had an entire section of PDF books that you could download, and they were like some of the best revisionist books, not really dealing with the Holocaust, but dealing just with all aspects of Western history. And I remember coming across a pamphlet of this speech, and I was just like, whoa, this is not anything I'd ever learned about in school. I was simply shocked. And Benjamin Friedman, for those of you who don't know, was like a major insider. He was a quite wealthy Jewish businessman. I believe he ran a soap company? I think that's how he made his money, yeah.
Yeah, he was a millionaire, and this was, you know, the 1930s, late 2030s, and there weren't too many millionaires at that time.
Yeah, so he was like this very wealthy businessman, very connected, had major connections to the political elite in Washington, D.C., and also in the organized Jewish community. And in this speech, I mean, he thoroughly explained how, I mean, basically Jewish handlers manipulated both Woodrow Wilson and his administration to enter World War I on the side of the British, and also how the Zionists in London enticed Lord Balfour to issue the infamous Balfour Declaration, which basically pledged support, British support, for a future Jewish state in modern day, what's now modern day Israel. I mean, at the time it was administered, this land was administered by the British through their mandate system, right? And so it's just an incredibly, I'm trying to think of the word, just a very powerful, you know, historical narrative that you just are never even allowed to entertain. This certainly is not presented in high school, right?
Never presented in high school. In fact, you don't hear much about World War I anywhere, really. You hear a lot about World War II, but you never hear anything about World War I.
Yeah. Do you recall, like, where – I know you said you think you saw it, like, on some website or something. You don't recall exactly how you came across the work of Benjamin Friedman? Because it's not – you know, he's certainly not, like, a common name that people would know about. Even people that are interested in history, it's very much suppressed.
Well, you know, I had a job in 2015, a graveyard shift, and for a security company where basically I monitored, you know, alarms going off. And, you know, in the middle of the night, there's really nothing going on. So I had like a little between like 1 a.m. and 4 a.m. I had a piece of time there where like I'm at work, I'm getting paid. There's all I'm doing is staring at these screens. There's nothing to do. So I would go on the internet and I started researching a bunch of stuff. And I had been into, you know, researching assassinations and quote unquote conspiracies for a long time. And when the Sandy Hook shooting occurred in 2012, I discovered a website. I can't think of the name of it right now, but they did a lot of good work regarding that alleged shooting. And they had a bunch of links on their website to other websites they recommended. And I remember, you know, looking through their recommended other websites, I would click on this website and that website. And it goes from, you know, fake shootings and assassinations to the moon landing hoax, to, you know, to this story, you know, to World War II, back and forth like that. And I don't remember the specific site where I found Friedman, but it was somewhere in there, you know, where I'm just jumping around. You read a great article and it's like, and then there's a list of, you know, other recommended articles and books to read. So you go there and, you know, I'm just jumping around. So I don't remember specifically where I heard about Friedman, but
right.
He had that name, you know, has been in my head for several years before I read the book.
Okay, interesting. Wow, that sounds so similar to my story. You know, once you get on the internet and start looking into this sort of stuff, it's like one thing leads to another, leads to another, leads to another. Next thing you know, you're questioning literally everything you've ever been taught, whether it's
Pretty much, the
moon landing or the shooting. Yeah, exactly. So that's encouraging to hear, because that's exactly how it was for me. And I was interested in all of it, and I was like, I got to figure all this stuff out. And that's pretty much what's consumed most of my time the past 10 years at this point. But no, it's that's interesting. And you know what? Why don't you kind of – I mean, the article itself is not like super, super long. It's basically like a 5 or 6 page review of the book. What did you find most interesting in, you know, reading the book and writing the review? What historical revelations did you find most interesting?
The World War One stuff was fascinating, but for me personally, what I found the most interesting, and this was not a surprise to me, I had researched this before, but Friedman, in his book, he lays out the evidence that Jesus was not a Jew. Now, when you first hear that, you know, you go, wait, what? You know, because it runs counter to everything you've been taught and everything you've heard. We were all told that Christianity comes from Judaism and that Jesus was a Jew and the apostles were all Jews. But as Friedman points out in this book, and I verify this myself with my own research, the word Jew does not appear in any Bible until the 1700s. And for over 1,000 years, there was no use of the word Jew in any Bible. The word used correctly translated was Judean, which referred to people living in an area of Judea. In the same way that you call people living in America Americans, or people living in Canada Canadians, that's how the word Jew was used in the original Bible, was that referring to the area of Judea.
And
Jesus was from Bethlehem.
Yeah, well, and Judea itself was a Roman province, right? It was like a Roman administrative unit, right? It didn't specifically refer to an ethnicity or particular religious group. It was more of a civic sort of administrative unit, right? That's my understanding,
right.
Anyways.
There was no racial or religious connotation to the word at all. None. And the Bible does not say anywhere that Jesus had any connection whatsoever to the people, the race, or the religion that we refer to today as Jews or Judaism. It's
right.
Just not there.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I think if, you know, an accurate understanding interpretation of the Bible would recognize that Jesus was actually condemning the people that we know today as Jews, and the people were some of the leading proponents of actually executing Jesus when he was, you know, when Pontius Pilate presented the leaders of Judea at the time, you know, who do you want? Should we execute Jesus, or was it Barabbas, I think?
Yeah.
And so, you know, I think that's a much more accurate and, you know, just historically accurate understanding of the Bible and what actually took place in the ethnic or racial groups involved there.
You're right. And he tells Friedman in his book, there's a fascinating story about Pontius Pilate and the inscription that he had inscribed upon the cross. We're told that it said King of the Jews, but that's incorrect. The real words, when properly translated into English, were Jesus the Nazarene, ruler of the Judeans. And those words were intended to mock the people who crucified Jesus. Because remember, Pilate, he didn't want to crucify Jesus, but he was faced with this mob of hundreds, possibly thousands of people crying out, just, you know, crucify him, crucify him. But he didn't want to do it. And according to all historical accounts, he only had a small garrison of men there, and they were armed with swords and spears. There were no firearms back then. So if this mob had rioted, he and his men were completely outnumbered. If the mob had rioted, they probably would have all been killed. So Pilate basically kind of wimped out and washed his hands of the whole affair because he didn't want the crowd to riot, and he didn't want to risk him and his men getting overthrown and killed. It's kind of like what we call today passive-aggressive behavior. He ordered the words put on the cross, Jesus, the Nazarene ruler of the Judeans, to mock this mob that demanded his crucifixion. Because he felt guilty because they knew he pumped out on it. It's like if you've ever seen, you know, some huge guy picking on a little guy, and the little guy backs off, and as the little guy's backing off, he continues to throw insults at the big guy to sort of pretend to show he's not afraid, even though he obviously is because he's backing off. That's kind of what Pilate did. You know, he backed off, but because he felt guilty about that, he ordered those words put on the cross as a way of mocking them. And according to the Gospel of St. John, you know, the chief priests all complained about that, but Pilate said, "What I have written, I have written." And he left it on the sign.
Yeah, no, that's fascinating. And this is something that Friedman explains in you know, layman's terms, basically. I mean, it's not like super complicated to read, but he explains it very, very well in the book. And if I'm not mistaken, I mean, the first part of the book is the Willard Hotel speech, right, where he kind of explains the intrigues leading up to the Balfour Declaration and, you know, U.S. involvement in World War One and the ultimate creation of the State of Israel, and also just the reality of, like, Jewish Zionist power and influence in American politics and media and, you know, the banking system. So he exposed a lot of this sort of stuff. But then later in the book, isn't it he's writing it's like a correspondence between him and another Jewish guy, both of whom converted to Catholicism. And he's sort of like, right. It's sort of like a back and forth about some of these more controversial, you know, misunderstandings of, you know, who Jesus was, who the modern Jews are, that sort of thing, right?
Yeah, I think the person he wrote the letter to was David Goldstein.
Yep, exactly.
Yep. Who also converted. But even though Goldstein converted, he was still making a lot of mistakes, you know, referring to Jesus as a Jew, etc. So Friedman wrote him this long letter, and that makes up the bulk of the book.
Yeah, and you know what? Let me actually read. You have a really good excerpt from the book in the article that pretty much, you know, nails like exactly pretty much everything we're talking about. But it kind of articulates Friedman's views and debunks this idea that Jesus is or was a quote unquote Jew, people that, you know, we know today as Jews. And this is directly from the book. It says here, to allege that Jesus was a Jew in the sense that during his lifetime, Jesus professed and practiced the form of religious worship known and practiced under the modern name of Judaism is false and fiction in the most blasphemous manner. Jesus abhorred and denounced the form of religious worship practiced today under its new name, Judaism. That religious belief was then known as Phariseeism. The Christian clergy learned that in their theological seminary days, but they have never made any attempt to make that clear to Christians, which really kind of says it all right there, right? I mean, this is something that I think a lot of Christian preachers certainly knew about in the past. I mean, I don't know what it's like today, but I mean, this idea that Jesus was a Jew or just, you know, somehow descendant of the people we know today as Jews is just simply not true. And the Jews themselves even admit this in their own writings.
Yeah, they do admit it. Friedman said that Catholicism and Judaism are at the opposite extremes of the spiritual spectrum. Totally opposites. You got one on one end and the other on the other end, and then everything else is sort of in the middle.
Right, exactly.
Well, but what Christians, else? You know, so-called Christians don't realize that.
Yeah. Well, and another thing that he exposed very thoroughly in this book is the very evil nature of the Talmud, which, again, is something that, you know, most Christians simply have no idea about. I mean, I think most Christians somehow believe that, you know, Jews, you know, some like worship the Old Testament, and, you know, I don't know. I think that there's just a lot of misunderstandings about the nature of Judaism, when in reality, the Talmud is a systematic critique and undermining of traditional Mosaic law, and basically is a, you know, like a get out of jail free card, essentially.
It has so many blasphemous parts of the Talmud, and some of it is just completely revolting. Absolutely revolting what the Talmud says about Jesus, what it says about Mary, the Virgin Mary. Most people are just completely unaware of this. I was unaware of it until just a few years ago, and then I heard about a book called The Talmud Unmasked. And you can read a lot of the quotes in there. All non-Jew children are animals. When a Jew murders a non-Jew, there will be no death penalty. A man who engaged in intercourse with a girl less than 3 years of age has done nothing. Jews must destroy books of the Christians, i.e. the New Testament. And by the way, there's a new law proposed in Israel. I don't know if you heard this, but it's going to, if it gets passed, it's going to make saying the name Jesus illegal, punishable by jail time.
I saw that. Yeah. Did that actually get passed? I saw it, like some headlines about it, you know, being proposed. I don't know if it's actually been passed or, you know, implemented. Okay.
I think it's pending right now. It hasn't been passed yet.
Well, you know what? Frankly, I think it's obviously an important story, but I think the bigger picture here to understand is that there's a long history of Jewish persecution of Christians in the Middle East since the founding of the State of Israel. I mean, there are regular like terrorist attacks and arson attacks and vandalism committed against Christian churches in the Middle East, whether it's the Orthodox churches there or the Catholic churches there or whatever. There's a lot of persecution and hostility towards Christians in Israel itself. And again, this is something that most people don't know about. It's not like reported on regularly. You know, it's pretty much covered up and hidden, just like the nature of the Talmud and the, you know, the nature of Judaism itself.
It's completely hidden. I would love to go to Israel just to visit the holy places, you know, if they're accurate. But I'm not going there because of everything you just said. I don't want to get spit on. If you show up with the Bible, with the New Testament, if that law passes, you could go to jail for that.
Yeah.
But
think about like how much we go on and on about religious freedom and this sort of nonsense, this rhetoric we hear regularly, you know, from our political leaders. And meanwhile, in Israel, you can't even – I don't know exactly the details of the law, but there really isn't too much religious freedom in Israel.
No. You know, it's – when I – a few years ago, I started listening to a radio talk show host on AM radio called Dennis Prager.
Oh, yeah.
And,
yeah.
I didn't know a lot of the stuff that I know now then. So I'm listening to him and he's talking about the Judeo-Christian tradition. And he makes it sound basically like everything, if you're a conservative, then you have to be supportive of Israel and you have to support them wholeheartedly. And, it, you know, when I first heard that, you know, for a couple of months, I kind of thought I kind of went along with it until I started investigating this more and more on my own. And then I realized, you know, everything that he says is conservative is really the antithesis of conservatism. I mean, he's trying, it's like all of, and he's not the only one. It's like all of these AM radio talk show hosts, along with a lot of writers and a lot of so-called, you know, pastors, they try to equate their conservatism with whatever is good for Israel when they're pretty much opposite. It's like putting Judaism and Catholicism together. They're at opposite ends of the spectrum. And you could pretty much say the same thing with supporting Israel and true conservatism. Conservatism, they're on the opposite ends of the spectrum.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Well, that's very common. It's like an inversion tactic and you know, just a manipulative tactic to get these totally brainwashed, deluded Christian Zionists to just continue to pledge unwavering support for Israel. You know, every once in a while when I catch Fox News, you know, I'll watch some of the commercials, and almost invariably there's a commercial about Jewish, you know, victims in Ukraine and how you need to send money to help the Jews in Ukraine escape the, you know, the persecution of the Russians, or even worse, about some Holocaust survivor and, you know, some poor Holocaust survivor that doesn't have any money and is, you know, relying on handouts and, you know, like welfare in Israel to survive. you know, donate here and, you know, make sure that these Holocaust survivors survive and, you know, don't go hungry. I mean, it's just like one scam after the other, you know, perpetrated against these, you know, Christian Zionists, and still so many of them can't see through it. It's pathetic.
That's sad. I know. But it's Jesus somewhere in the Bible says only a few go to heaven. You know, most don't make it. Most people follow, only a few follow the narrow path. Most follow the wide path and they end up going to hell. I'm determined not to follow that wide path. That's part of my motivation with reading all of these books and studying this information. I want to make sure that it's like every man for himself. You know, I need to go to heaven. I need to save myself first. And then after I make sure that I'm going there, I want to try and get other people to go up there too. So I don't want to be selfish. I want to try and help others. But if they're not going to listen, they're not going to listen. And after a while, you know, you know how this is. You try to wake people up. You give them articles. You give them videos. You give them information, true information. They don't want to see it. Either they don't look at it at all, or they give it a very cursory look and then deny it. But they can't use any relevant evidence or facts to back up their denials, which is kind of why I like Friedman's book. And it's a perfect title, too, Facts or Facts, because he lays it out. He lays out the facts. Our society, we live where everyone has an opinion, but nobody has any real facts. They think they know the difference, but they think their opinions are actually facts. But what their opinions are just word for word regurgitations of something they heard on television, or they heard some Dennis Prager or some guy on the radio say. So they're repeating that gibberish, thinking it's their own thoughts, thinking it's real, but none of it's true.
Yeah, exactly. Well, and yeah, again, that's the book is very, very powerful, very straightforward, very matter of fact. You know, he's basically spelling it out right there, you know, on all these controversial topics, and it's stuff that you just will never be presented with in a mainstream history book or in school or at the university. I mean, he basically exposed, I just kind of made some notes here, like basically Jewish handlers at the highest levels of American politics, you know, going back to the Woodrow Wilson administration and probably even before that, but certainly the Woodrow Wilson administration, and then, you know, in the post-World War I era leading up to World War II, the Franklin Delano Roosevelt administration was, I wouldn't say like totally ran by Jews, but there were a lot of Jewish individuals involved and tons of communist agents. That has been thoroughly documented and exposed even by the FBI's own records, right? Are you familiar with like the Venona decrypts? And
no,
you know,
I haven't heard of that.
Yeah, I mean, like a lot of these guys in the FDR administration were like outright Soviet agents, not merely, you know, sympathizers of communism, but like outright agents of the Soviet Union. So this has been a problem for a very long time with our government, and Friedman was exposing this all in great detail in this book, Facts or Facts, you know, all the way back to the World War I era. And of course, you know, as we talked about, he exposed the true nature of the Talmud and just who the Jews are and what their religion is really like, and you know, just the Jewish Zionist control of American society. I mean, he was thoroughly exposing and detailing this in the book, and you know, again, it's something that most people are just simply totally unaware of. And it wasn't some, you know, random, quote-unquote, anti-Semite. I mean, this was a very well-connected businessman, very wealthy, very successful, you know, knew all the key players in the top Zionist organizations at the time. I mean, this was, like, truly an elite member of American society back then. And he was, you know, knew everybody, you know, had a lot of experience dealing with these people. And, you know, good for him for actually standing up and telling the truth and exposing this stuff. But, you know, I guess my point is that he wasn't just some random, like, quote-unquote, anti-Semite off the streets. This was a very well-connected, powerful individual.
Very much so. You know, it's one thing to research history and current events as an outsider, like most of us are, but Friedman was definitely an insider. He personally knew Woodrow Wilson, Roosevelt, Joseph Kennedy, John F. Kennedy, Bernard Baruch, Samuel Untermeyer. He knew all these people personally.
Stephen Wise, I believe. Yeah.
Yeah, he knew them all. He saw what was going on with his own eyes.
Yeah, absolutely. And I would encourage anybody out there listening, if you have not, at the very least, you've got to read the 19, or I think you can even actually listen to it on YouTube or maybe BitChute. I know there's like audio recordings of it, but you can find the pamphlet, the 1961 Willard Hotel speech. It is just absolutely mind-blowing. I mean, and it's not very long either. It's not like, some, you know, you could read it in like a matter of, you know, 20 or 30 minutes. It's not like super, super long by any means. And it's definitely worth reading and just considering the perspective that he is espousing. And, you know, there's a lot of truth to what he's saying. And again, he's, you know, very much an insider in all this, exposing this stuff to the American public because he was so concerned about the future of the country and just what these international Zionist organizations and these, you know, big Jewish groups were getting the U.S. involved in. You know, it was totally contrary to our interests. It certainly benefited their interests, the organized Jewish community's interests and this international Zionist movement's interests, but it absolutely did not benefit the American people in any way.
I believe he spent $2.5 million of his own money up to that point of 1961. And, you know, it's a lot of money now, but back then it was a lot more money.
He put his money where his mouth was. Yeah.
He spoke and, you know, he gave that speech in 61, which was a long time ago. And things were the way he spoke about it then, it was a pretty drastic situation. So you can only imagine what it's like now with all this time to consolidate control.
Oh, absolutely, yeah. And I know that's sort of how you kind of concluded your piece as well. If he was, you know, exposing the stuff back then, think of how much worse it is today. And yeah, you're absolutely right. Where, you know, you look at the Biden administration, and I mean, it's almost like to a man, you know, a Jewish individual in every key position of power and influence. Certainly the most important positions of power, like the Department of Homeland Security, the Attorney General, the Secretary of State. I mean, it's just incredible.
It's you know, one reason why people don't want to get into this stuff is it tends to get a bit depressing. On the one hand, but on the other hand, I mean, do you just want to wallow in normalcy? Do you just want to go around, you know, believing all these lies and submitting to all this nonsense? I mean, look at the whole scamdemic we just had.
Did you see that Biden officially declared it's over?
Yeah,
he rescinded the emergency order or whatever.
Yeah, you know, it's like the people. I don't know where it is where you are, but where I live, the people, about 70% of the people here are still wearing masks.
Still?
And yeah, still. And about maybe 10% of the people I see in cars are still wearing masks.
Boy, they sure did a number on us with that whole pandemic situation, didn't they?
I know. But you know what it is? I mean, I think it's two things. I think it's mental illness. I think 90% or more of the population in America are legitimately mentally ill. And I also think there might be some demonic possession involved in all this too, because it's just, I don't know how else to explain it. I mean, you could say it's, well, stupidity, and it is, but there's got to be something more to that. It can't just be common stupidity. It's just the hysteria that we saw for those 2 years. I don't know how else to describe it other than A, mental illness, and B, demonic possession. And when you figure that, you know, the way pornography is running rampant, and this trannyism and all this other stuff, I wouldn't doubt if most of these people that are into all of that are, you know, are suffering from some kind of demonic possession.
Yeah. Yeah, I think you're definitely onto something. There's no doubt about that. Yeah. Yeah, it's just a crazy situation we find ourselves in. But you know what? I want to kind of wrap up, and there's actually a couple other articles I kind of wanted to get into, but I don't think I'm going to have time to really do justice to the second one. So maybe I'll try to schedule an entire show. There was I'll just mention it briefly. There was a recent article put out by the Anti-Defamation League. It's titled Holocaust Denial, Anatomy of an Anti-Semitic Conspiracy Theory. And parts of this, it's like a, I guess like a, it's a, and it's an entire page on their website. And on this one page, they have a number of different like sub articles. And one of them, actually a couple of them, actually kind of go after the Barnes Review History magazine. So I was going to bring that up and kind of talk about it, but we're really not going to have enough time to kind of do it justice. So I'll just mention that, and you know, I'll try to schedule somebody in the next couple weeks to talk about it in more detail. But getting back to a point that we kind of made at the very beginning, and that is this systematic perversion of history and the like systematic erasure of whites in the historical record and in popular culture. And I mean, I think it's pretty clear that the historical record, at least the, you know, the mainstream establishment, politically correct historical narrative, has been totally weaponized against whites in particular. But really, I mean, I think the entire world, I mean, history has been politicized to such an extent that it advances certain agendas that really don't benefit anyone in the long run, except for this, you know, organized international Zionist Jewish network that has its tentacles virtually, you know, all throughout society. And we see this very clearly with this, you had mentioned it earlier, I know we talked about it before we started recording, this controversy surrounding this new Netflix series called Queen Cleopatra, where they are featuring a black actress as Queen Cleopatra, which is probably one of the most insulting and absurd things, considering that Cleopatra is actually of Macedonian Greek heritage, certainly no African. She was probably blonde and blue eyes. And yet, you know, we have this African actress playing it. So there's this huge controversy about it. I'm actually looking at an article that I just came across the other day, published in The Archaeologist. It's thearchaeologist.org. I can I'll post a link to it when I, you know, when I post this podcast program. But there's this huge effort to cancel the show, basically. And it's already garnered over 60,000 signatures. And this article was published on April 15th, so a few days ago. And they're basically demanding that the show be canceled because it's so politicized and it's not even accurate. And, you know, it's sort of generated this debate. I mean, we see this from time to time. I remember when that – did you ever catch that major Broadway musical production, Hamilton?
No,
you know, basically dealing with Alexander Hamilton. And Alexander Hamilton, you know, there's a lot of people in the, you know, dissident right and the, you know, dissident, you know, revisionist historical community that have a lot of criticisms of Alexander Hamilton. But I think we can all agree that Alexander Hamilton was definitely not a black guy. and yet they had a black man, you know, play Alexander Hamilton in this Broadway play. And it's just like a total insult, right? I mean, sometimes I can't even believe it, but yet here we are. It's just totally insulting, and it's unacceptable. And I'm glad that there's a big uproar over this Queen Cleopatra Netflix series, where people are just openly demanding that the show be outright canceled. I'm certainly not going to watch it, but I mean, talk about it, you know, a total insult. We know for sure that Queen Cleopatra was her ancestry came from Macedonia, you know, the Greek Macedonians, and yet they want to portray her as this black queen, which is just absurd.
I think it's deliberately done to insult people. I don't think it's going to make a whole bunch of difference, you know, because most people don't care about history anyway. And those that do are going to know that Cleopatra was Greek. So, I think the influence, you know, in that sense is minimal. But I think it's just done as an insult. And I personally have no sympathy for anyone that watches anything on Netflix. I mean, they should have canceled their subscriptions a few years ago when they put out that show Cuties, you know, which was the sexualization of children. Remember that?
Yeah. It was like basically was totally outright promoting like pedophilia, basically.
Yeah. So anyone who's still watching Netflix, or actually any, you know, present company excluded, but I think anyone watching television or movies at this point just needs to have their head examined. I mean, these are industries whose owners openly hate us, you know, and yet people are still watching. I don't understand. I recommend everybody kill their television.
Yeah, I mean, I can't even remember the last time I actually paid for a cable subscription. I mean, it's been at least 10 years, maybe even longer than, probably, yeah, actually, definitely probably longer than even 10 years. And I mean, that goes for Netflix, that goes for, I mean, you know, pretty much the only thing that I watch, like audio visual wise, is YouTube or Odyssey. You know, I mean, I don't even turn on a TV, you know, most days of the week, practically never, in fact. And if I do turn on a TV, I'm streaming something from YouTube or Odyssey. So, you know, I don't know. I'm so disconnected from any sort of like mainstream entertainment. It's almost like, you know, I have no idea what's going on in television. And when I do come across it, like if I'm out somewhere and I see it and people start talking about it, I'm like, I have no idea what you're even talking about, and I want nothing to do with it. No comment. If you guys want to talk about this, go ahead, but I'm gonna go over here. I don't want anything to do with this.
Could you imagine how much better society would be if everybody turned off their televisions and instead picked up a copy of the Barnes Review to read?
Right, yeah, exactly. Well, and to me, I mean, it's much more, what I mean, just I have no interest in anything on, you know, mainstream television. I mean, I'd much rather educate myself or read something interesting. I mean, that's the
It's
thing.
all
Like,
crap.
yeah, it is. It's terrible and it's insulting, it's degrading. It is just blatant. It's like, and it's so blatant in your face at this point. I mean, look at this Cleopatra show, for example, and there's many, many other examples. But yeah, it's just, I mean, if you like to be insulted, if you like to be programmed and brainwashed and groomed, you know, to, you know, support or justify, you know, homosexuals and transgenderism and even pedophilia, as you mentioned with that other show, Cuties. I mean, yeah, go ahead and watch Netflix and turn on your television. But if you want nothing to do with that, if you recognize it as very subversive and outright evil, then yeah, turn it off, disengage, pick up a book, pick up a copy of the Barnes Review, as you mentioned, and pick up a copy of Facts or Facts by Benjamin Friedman and check out what he had to say. I mean, I find that much more interesting, much more enlightening, much more fulfilling than, you know, watching anything on Netflix. I'll tell you that right now.
Most definitely.
Yeah, man. Well, Mike, I'll tell you what, man. I will let you go. Thank you very much for taking the time to speak with me. We'll have to do this again. I look forward to future contributions in the Barnes Review. And once again, I would just encourage everybody to check out the website, barnesreview.org, and pick up a subscription if you are not already subscribing. So, Mike, thanks, man. I appreciate it. You enjoy your weekend, and I will be in touch.
Thanks, John. Have a great day.
Okay, you too.